can't get rid of the 2 out of 3 rule without a substantial quid pro quo. That quid pro quo would be to have these tax breaks for smaller publications in order to give accelerated tax write-offs, R&D type tax write-offs, to smaller publications that would turbocharge the employment of journalists.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Senate crossbencher Nick Xenophon has plenty on his mind just now. He's one of those whose citizenship is before the High Court, with the case to be heard within weeks. But before that, he's in talks with the government about its legislation to deregulate media ownership rules, which is before the Senate, with the Nick Xenophon team key players in the last stages of negotiation. Nick Xenophon, your failure to do a deal in the last sitting week over media meant that the American giant CBS was able to pip Lachlan Murdoch at the Post to grab Channel 10. Murdoch and Bruce Gordon needed the new rules to have been passed to get the ownership. Is the CBS entry a good thing or a bad thing?
The reason why there wasn't an agreement reached on media reform in that last sitting week wasn't for want of trying on my part or on the part of my team. We put up a proposal, package of measures to the government which we thought were sensible, were measured. It would have encouraged more diversity in the media. It would have provided tax breaks and other benefits to smaller media organisations, including smaller mastheads as part of bigger organisations. But the government didn't come at that. They balked at that, and we're still talking to the government in good faith. So it wasn't through lack of trying, because I was hopeful that we could have got an agreement, an arrangement by that last sitting week. Since that time, there's been the CBS deal. Of course, these sorts of deals are always subject to votes of shareholders, of creditors, because the company's in administration. I have been genuinely neutral in that. My concern has always been about diversity of media, the number of journalists that could be employed at Channel 10, the newsrooms being robust, and I didn't want to pick sides as to whether it was Lachlan Murdoch and Bruce Gordon on the one hand or CBS on the other.
On the other hand, though, CBS coming in would provide more diversity than if the Lachlan Murdoch, Bruce Gordon bid had succeeded, wouldn't it?
Well, not necessarily. CBS, of course, is a venerable media institution based in the US. The issues there are that it depends what guarantees CBS would give on local jobs. On the other hand, the Murdoch-Gordon deal could have seen a synergy with WIN TV in terms of regional coverage being enhanced as part of a deal with Channel 10. So there are so many variables there. I just want to make sure we have more journalists, not fewer journalists, being employed in this country.
So where are you up to in this deal at the moment? Do you think you will get tax breaks for smaller organisations?
Well, I hope so, because if we can't get a substantive series of reforms, then it makes it impossible for me to support what the government is proposing. You can't get rid of the 2 out of 3 rule without a substantial quid pro quo. That quid pro quo would be to have these tax breaks for smaller publications in order to give accelerated tax write-offs, R&D type tax write-offs, to smaller publications that would turbocharge the employment of journalists. And of course, you would have to have adequate safeguards, strong safeguards around it, so it can't be activist organisations using this tax write-off. It would have to be a case of it being for genuine public interest journalism, reporting the news, discussing issues, advancing public debate, informing the public. These are all things that we need more of, not less of, in this country.
Now, you said you'll oppose the concessions the government has given Pauline Hanson, which could clip the ABC's wings. But exactly how are you going to knock those out?
Well, very simply, if the government puts up legislation in relation to the ABC,
which would be separate from the media package,
yes, we will have not real difficulty in supporting it. We won't be supporting it. If the legislation is legislation that compromises the ABC's editorial independence, if it sees the ABC's budget being cut in any way, if it has a requirement to disclose salaries above $200,000, well, in the corporate world, talk to people about that, those disclosure requirements can actually be counterproductive and push up salaries at the ABC, which is completely against the grain of it saving taxpayers' money. So the short answer is not impressed with what's being put up and therefore can't support it.
But surely the government anticipated this in some way, because otherwise it can't deliver to Hanson, and Hanson wants that delivery if she's supporting the other package.
Can I say this? That's not my issue. That's a matter between the government and One Nation. I do support what the government's announced with One Nation in terms of community radio. That is unambiguously a good measure, and in fact, I negotiated on behalf of my colleagues a package of measures that meant close to $6 million for community radio in the forward estimates that would really help them grow and thrive. This additional package is very, very welcome, because community radio is a medium that more and more Australians are turning to, and it's very accessible, very grassroots, and that's a good thing.
Let's turn to your citizenship issues. Can you explain just very briefly what the problem is, or the alleged problem, and what's your legal advice? Do you think you're okay?
Well, the nature of the problem is that my father left Cyprus and arrived in Australia in early 1951. At the time, Cyprus was a British colony. It was under British occupation, and he travelled here on British travel documents. By virtue of the fact that I was born in 1959 and Cyprus didn't become a republic until 1960, there is a rare peculiarity, as the British Home Office calls it, that they say deems me to have British overseas citizenship, which, by the way, is only one step above being stateless. It is a pretty miserable form of citizenship, if you want to call it that. That obviously has been dug up by my political opponents. I had absolutely no idea that I could have been entitled to this form of citizenship. Out of an abundance of caution, I went through a process of renunciation, even though I made the point to the British Home Office, I'm only doing this in the event that I am a British overseas citizen.
This is recently.
Very recently. Cost me $334. I don't know what that translates to in Australian dollars, probably about $500 or so. Very painful to part with that money, but
for it might be cheaper the price.
Well, exactly, but can I just tell you, my father left Cyprus because of British occupation. That's a great irony, because it was a colony, it wasn't democratic, it was not a very pleasant occupation, and he left Cyprus in order to get away from British occupation.
So is your advice that you are okay, you will be okay?
Well, I can only tell you the advice of my barrister, of my counsel, is that it should be fine, and I know that eminent constitutional lawyers, such as Professor Anne Toomey, have said that I have the best case of the bunch of seven, the High Court seven, I call them. So we'll wait and see what happens.
So the opposition is arguing that Barnaby Joyce, and indeed Fiona Nash in the Senate, should stand down from the ministry while their cases are determined. What do you think on that?
Look, what I think of that, there are two aspects of it. Legally, if you're entitled to be a Member of Parliament, declared elected, duly elected, then you're entitled to hold any positions of higher office, even if that means Deputy Prime Minister or a Minister of the Crown. So there is no legal impediment to Barnaby Joyce or Fiona Nash continuing to serve in the ministry, continue to serve in a position of higher office. Politically, I can see the difficulty, because Senator Canavan stepped down from the ministry. I think that he did so perhaps prematurely. I think he didn't need to do so, but I can understand he wanted to defuse the position. So politically, it will probably be tidier if Senator Nash and Barnaby Joyce stood to one side, but they don't have to, and I think they are perfectly entitled to sit in that, to hold that higher office.
There's also some doubt, though, over ministerial decisions, if they were ruled out.
Now, sadly, Michelle, I have read up on the doctrine of de facto officers, which I'm very happy to provide you with the papers that I've been reading. If you have suffered from insomnia, I'm sure it will cure you of insomnia. But essentially, the legal position in that, and presumably the Commonwealth has received legal advice from the Solicitor General, is that those decisions will be can be validated if there is a problem. And I'm not too concerned about that, having looked at the whole doctrine of de facto officers.
If you were ruled out, if the worst happened, what would then happen? Do you have another person in your team who'd be elected in your place on a recount? And surely they would have to resign, because how can we have the Nick Xenophon team without Nick Xenophon?
No one's indispensable. Now, can I just say, you're such a glass half empty type of person today, aren't you? So negative today. You're not your normal glass half full sort of type of person. Can I just say that let's wait and see. I don't want to preempt what the wise women and men of the High Court will decide. The case will be heard on October the 10th, 11th, 12th. And I think we'll get some idea of as to the attitude of the court then in terms of how the arguments go. And I anticipate that the High Court will make a decision sooner rather than later. But of course, I want to make this clear, it's a matter for the High Court when they make that decision. But given the urgency of it, I'd imagine, and given the precedence in these sorts of matters, hopefully there'll be a decision sometime in November.
Just turning from your citizenship to the broader issue of citizenship, legislation's before the Parliament for tightening requirements for citizenship, including the English language test. There's been a lot of criticism of that, and also a longer period of requirement, waiting period for citizenship. What's your thoughts on this?
My Senate colleague Sterling Griff has been going to those hearings and he's been more involved in that. But look, we have some serious concerns about the legislation in its current form. The four-year period may not be so bad on its own, but it would actually cause all sorts of issues by being effectively retrospective, especially for those families that have children about to start university, and they would be at a significant disadvantage. There's also the issue of the requirement to have university standard English language requirements, which I guess a lot of even members of Parliament may have difficulty in passing, including me. So I think that it seems incredibly onerous, and I think that's reached too far. One of the reasons why this country has been such a great success is because of its great migration programs. The fact that almost one in two Australians were either born overseas or had at least one parent born overseas, I think is indicative of that. And I think there are parts of this legislation that simply go too far. Whether it is beyond repair or not remains to be seen, but I'll wait to see the Senate committee report that I think is coming out tomorrow in relation to that.
Now, just finally, because you're tight for time and have to be in the Senate very soon, preparations are well underway for the marriage postal ballot, although we're still waiting for the High Court to say whether it's legal or not. Where do you stand on this, and what role are you going to play in the campaign?
Well, firstly, my position, those of my colleagues, is very clear. We support marriage equality. We also think it is completely unnecessary to spend $122 million of taxpayer money on a postal ballot because the government couldn't get its way by having a plebiscite on this issue. This is a political construct for the government to get out of the pickle because of its own internal issues in respect to this. But having said that, if we're going to have the postal ballot, as unnecessary as we think it is, or in the first place, then I'll be voting yes. I would urge people to vote yes. If we're going to go through this massive expense, let's not waste it. And if that will provide the reason for the coalition to finally vote on this in the chambers, then let's get on with it. It's an embarrassment that we haven't determined this issue through the
Parliament. But are you going to campaign, and are your colleagues
well,
going to campaign?
Well, I'm campaigning right now on the conversation. Please vote yes. Do not let this opportunity go by.
And do you think that it will survive the High Court challenge?
That's above my pay grade. If it doesn't, it's back to square one. If it does, we should just get on with it and support it.
It's not quite clear where square one would be, though, if it was knocked out.
I know, you're being very glass half empty today.
Do you think we'd get a vote in the Parliament, or would the right of the Liberal Party just say no?
This will be a festering sore for the coalition if we don't have a vote. It will actually cost them votes at the next election. It will cost votes for those inner metropolitan seats particularly, and it will actually hurt coalition members. There's nothing to be gained for them politically unless they can resolve this issue one way or the other.
Nick Xenophon, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all for today's podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage will be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.